This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Within the past 24 hours, both the Florida legislature and the United States Senate approved bills that touch on the emotionally charged intersection of individual rights, medical science, politics, and morality. In Tallahassee, the law gave Governor Jeb Bush the authority to order that a feeding tube be reinserted into a 39-year-old woman named Terry Schiavo, who's been in a vegetative state for 13 years. In Washington, the U.S. Senate voted 64-34 to ban a procedure doctors call intact dilation and extraction. Anti-abortion activists call it partial birth abortion. In both cases, the legislatures acted to get around previous court decisions. Both of these new measures will be challenged. If they survive judicial review, neither is expected to affect large numbers of people directly. Both, however, have acquired enormous symbolic significance. This hour, we'll focus on each of these cases and on the constitutional roles of legislatures and courts. Is there a right place for such decisions to be made? Is a policy established by court order less legitimate than a law passed by elected representatives? We'll also look at the politics in Washington and in Florida and ask where the movements involved on both sides go from here. We want to hear your views on these issues and where they should be decided. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to begin here in Washington, and joining us now from Capitol Hill is NPR's Julie Rovner. Always good to have you on the program, Julie.
Hi, Neil.
Vote yesterday in the Senate seems like an enormous victory for the anti-abortion movement.
Yes, I think so. Certainly, there, even though this has been kicking around, if you will, since 1995, there are really a number of people who said that it was important to have this victory to bring this to fruition. This is the third time that Congress has passed this bill and sent it to the president. Of course, the first two times it was vetoed by then-President Clinton. This time we know it's going to be signed by President Bush.
So that was basically what happened in terms of the politics of it, a change in the White House?
Yes, well, there were a couple of things, but generally, certainly the number of senators is still, as Senator Santorum, the sponsor of the bill, pointed out yesterday, they're not yet at two-thirds. So had there been an abortion rights supporting president in the White House, the Senate still would not have enough votes to override the veto. They would be in basically the same situation they were in 1995 and 1997.
So not enough to override a veto, but enough to stop a filibuster, more than the 60 needed for that.
Well, there had always been more. There's been more than 60 for several years. They had just never gotten up to that magic sort of 66 level. And in fact, yesterday, even though there were 64 votes, there was of a senator who was absent who would have voted for it. They would have gotten up to 65, but that would be the high water mark.
Now, we've heard this procedure called a lot of different things: intact dilation and extraction. That's the medical terminology. Partial birth abortion by activists involved. Why the different terminology? And exactly what kind of procedure is covered by this legislation?
Well, that the crux of the debate is what a partial birth abortion is. And I have actually the bill in front of me. I can read you just the one sentence. That this is, it's really a legislative term, not a medical term. And here's the description in the bill. It says it's a fetus, basically, it says, an abortion in which the entire fetal head is outside the body of the mother, or in the case of breech presentation, any part of the fetal trunk past the navel is outside the body of the mother, for the purpose of performing an overt act that the person knows will kill the partially delivered living fetus. That's basically the legislative terminology for a partial birth abortion. Now, the closest medical procedure that those on the other side recognize as fitting that description is what we call the intact dilation and extraction, or DNX. There's about 2,200 of those that we know of in the year 2000. That's the last year that we have complete statistics. That's out of 1.3 million abortions that year, so it's less than one half of 1%. Now, those on the other side, those who oppose the ban, say that this description actually could be interpreted more broadly and would cover many more abortions. So really, the crux of what's going to be a court fight is what that phrase means and which types of abortion it would cover.
Mm-hmm. And another issue is the word living, I would assume.
Yes, and that's there are abortion procedures in which, and this is one of the key distinctions, in which basically the fetus is killed before it's brought out of the mother. In this case, in these types of abortion, sometimes the fetus is still alive during the process of bringing it out. It all gets sort of very technical and kind of grisly, which is part of the point of this entire exercise for the anti-abortion movement. They want to really focus the debate on the gruesomeness of the abortion procedure, and they also want to focus debate on later in pregnancy when there's much more support for the anti-abortion cause as opposed to much earlier in pregnancy when there's much more support for the abortion rights cause. So this has been a major effort to sort of shift the debate to where in pregnancy you're talking about.
Yeah, the procedure has also been referred to sometimes, and I gather incorrectly, as late-term abortion. And in fact, at least according to the reading I've done, it happens most often in the second trimester.
Yes, that's right. I mean, late-term is one of those phrases without a lot of meaning, but if you ask 100 people, I think 80 of them would say late term is after a fetus is viable. And even those who support this legislation say, no, most of these abortions that we're talking about take place before viability. And that's one of the reasons why they opposed some of the legislative efforts to change this to a quote-unquote late-term abortion ban, because they're saying if late-term is post-viability, it wouldn't cover what they want to cover, because this isn't a late-term procedure.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's get a caller on the line. Holly joins us from Nashua, New Hampshire.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess my initial reaction was when I was hearing was that both of these cases and both of these decisions should clearly be ones that are made by doctors and their patients and by the guardians in the case of the Florida case, not at all by the courts or the legislature. I mean, I guess it's too late now, but I wanted to make sure that point that point was heard as well.
Yes. Julie Rovner, clearly it's way too late for that in either of these decisions. But I wanted to get your reaction to that. I mean, did this come up at all in the 8 years of the debate over this issue in the United States Senate, whether it was appropriate place for this to be decided?
This came up constantly in the 8 years of debate. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has been very much on record as opposing this bill. Again, they say this is a decision. This is the appropriate medical procedure should be decided by a doctor and a patient, not by Congress. The American Medical Association has actually been on both sides of this debate, kind of repeatedly on both sides of this debate. They actually endorsed the bill at one point and then later rescinded their endorsement. Bill Frist, of course, is a physician, the Senate Majority Leader, and he said yesterday that he considered this outside the mainstream of modern medicine, and yet there are doctors, many doctors on the other side. So this is a debate that has also split the medical community. But certainly those opposed to it have suggested that Congress is not, with the exception of Dr. Frist in the Senate, there aren't any doctors, and perhaps this is a decision that ought to be left to medical professionals.
Well, Holly, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And where do we go from here on this? Obviously, the courts have taken a position on this issue over the years as well, which has tended to, again, according to the reading I've done, Julie, tended to say that, you know, this is an infringement.
Well, it's certainly heading for a court battle. There's three lawsuits that are being prepared, actually, by four groups. Planned Parenthood will sue on behalf of its abortion providers. The ACLU will sue on behalf of the National Abortion Federation, another group of abortion providers. The Center for Reproductive Rights is going to sue on behalf of a number of doctors, including Dr. Leroy Carhart, who's the Nebraska physician, who they represented 3 years ago in the sort of case that looked at this issue. In fact, the case that this bill is trying to get around, that case was called Stenberg v. Carhart, and the Supreme Court actually struck down a very similar Nebraska law. Now, the sponsors of this bill say they have rewritten the definition to make it more specific so that they will get around the court's concern about that the definition was vague. That's why I read the definition. This is the new, what they say, tighter definition. There's also the question of the fact that this bill does not have an exception allowing use of the procedure to protect the pregnant woman's health, not just her life. There is a life of the woman exception. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court said in the Stenberg case that there needed to be a health exception. What sponsors have done here is they have put in 15 pages of congressional findings saying that this procedure is never medically necessary. So they say they don't need a health exception because it's not necessary, and that the court ought to take those findings into account. There's a lot of people, even on the anti-abortion side, who privately suggest that that's probably not likely to hold up in the court. What they're really hoping is that by the time this bill actually makes its way to the Supreme Court, that perhaps there will be a different makeup of the Supreme Court. The Stenberg case 3 years ago was a 5-4 decision. Arguably, they only need one justice to change to have it go the other way.
Okay, let's get another caller in. Karen joins us on the line from South Bend, Indiana.
Hello, Neil.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just calling, I guess, as a younger woman. I'm 33, and I've experienced an abortion, a miscarriage, and two live births. So I've kind of run the gamut of pregnancy experiences. And I guess I'm just really concerned about the reproductive rights element of this. And I see this decision as an erosion of Roe v. Wade. And I'm really concerned for women my age and younger who, you know, don't have any historical context, you know, to put Roe v. Wade into and maybe don't realize what's at risk.
Well, Julie Rovner, abortion rights advocates certainly would argue that this is the beginning of a slippery slope.
They certainly do, and that's one of their big concerns. But the other side has really done a magnificent job at sort of singling this out and getting particularly Democrats in Congress who have fairly strong records of supporting abortion rights to vote against this particular procedure. Again, there's an argument about what this particular procedure is and whether it may be more than one procedure and maybe more than one rarely used procedure. But whatever, there has been really over the past 8 years a tremendous sort of surge of support, at least for this issue. What it will then lead to remains to be seen. Mm.
Karen, thanks very much. Appreciate your perspective.
Thank you.
Okay. There are a couple of things left to talk about, Julie, one of which is they talked about in the bill that you read us, that passage of that bill, a living fetus. They didn't talk about a viable fetus. Is that an important distinction?
That's a very important distinction. This is really, that's the distinction I got back to earlier, which is why this is not a late-term procedure, that this is a procedure that is most often performed in the 5th and 6th months of pregnancy when fetuses are not necessarily viable. That is not the question here about viability. This is not intended to ban post-viability abortions. It's intended to ban both post- and pre-viability abortions.
Another issue has been always the penalties involved. Are there penalties that would be imposed on the woman involved in this operation?
No, there aren't. Actually, the only penalties are for the doctor, which is, again, I think an issue that the anti-abortion community didn't want to take on. They didn't want to sort of be subject to saying, well, you're going after the women. So they're actually only penalizing the doctors, at least in this bill.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there other aspects of the Roe v. Wade decision or procedures, individual procedures like this that can be sort of, you know, isolated that anti-abortion activists are going to take on now?
Well, I think really they would like to keep the debate sort of on the fetus rather than on the woman. There are a number of other bills that they're looking at. There are several bills that actually look at minors and abortions for minors, something called the Child Custody Protection Act that would make it illegal to take a pregnant minor across state lines to evade a parental notification or consent law in the girl's home state. Again, that's a situation where there is an enormous amount of public support on the side of parental rights, on the side of restricting abortions for minors. So basically what they're looking at is sort of taking the issues where they know they have public support and advancing those.
And are there any other procedures other than the DNX you talked about that would be banned by this law? And I gather, as you mentioned earlier, there's some dispute over that.
There is. Again, that's going to be part of what's going to be worked out in these court cases, whether this definition covers just this DNX procedure or whether it also might cover the much more common D&E procedure, dilation and evacuation. I noticed in wandering around the internet over the last week or so getting ready for this, that we've had all seen some of these fairly gruesome pictures that have been on the Senate floor depicting the partial birth abortion procedure. There's now a set of pictures depicting a D&E, which of course the sponsors of this bill say that they're not intending to ban. That's obviously not only equally gruesome, some would say it's more gruesome because it actually involves sort of taking apart the fetus still in the womb. So it's possible that they'll go after that next.
Julie Rovner, thanks very much as always.
Thank you.
NPR's Julie Rovner joined us from Capitol Hill. When we come back from a short break, we're going to focus on the decision in Florida where the legislature approved the power for the governor there, Jeb Bush, the president's brother, to reinsert a feeding tube into a woman who's been in a vegetative state for 13 years. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing two controversial decisions made by legislative bodies in the last 24 hours. Yesterday, the Senate approved a bill that would ban a procedure known medically as intact dilation and extraction, what opponents call the partial birth abortion ban. In Florida, legislators rushed to pass a bill to allow a feeding tube to be reinserted into a brain-damaged woman. where if you have opinions on these procedures and on these decisions by the legislatures, and later we're going to focus on where is the right place to make these decisions, in the courts or in the legislatures. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. And joining us now to help us better understand some of the medical aspects of the case in Florida, the definition of a persistent vegetative state, and why it's such a challenging issue for doctors and families, is Richard Knox. He's NPR's health and science correspondent. He's with us from his office in Boston. And welcome back to Talk of the Nation, Richard.
Hi, Neil.
What is a persistent vegetative state? Is this the same as a coma?
No, it's not. Persistent vegetative state is damage to the higher brain centers that control thought and awareness, consciousness, but a situation where the lower centers of the brain are left intact. So this means that a patient has sleep-wake cycles, the periods when the eyes are open and they can breathe on their own typically, and their reflexes are preserved, but they're not conscious and aware. And in a coma, that's an eyes-closed state, mm-hmm. and there aren't these sleep-wake cycles, which can look as though the patient knows what's going on.
Yeah, are there gray areas?
Yes, there are. I was talking earlier today to Dr. James Burnett of Dartmouth Medical School, who's an authority in this area, and he says that a persistent vegetative state can be a subtle diagnosis to make. He says that the terms persistent vegetative state and coma are thrown around loosely sometimes, which adds to the confusion. And in addition, there's another state which is described fairly recently by doctors that neurologists call minimally conscious. And that, as that suggests, patients who are in that state can make some gestures that suggest they have some level of awareness. The problem is that it really requires very close observation of patients by doctors who are trained to make this diagnosis. And this close observation has to continue over a long period of time. Persistent vegetative state should not be diagnosed, the doctors say, before about 30 days. And in some cases, young adults who've had head injury, some doctors say you really shouldn't diagnose it as a persistent vegetative state until a year has passed with no change. And one other thing, there is no definitive test for this. There's research on some fancy imaging tests such as positron emission tomography or PET mm-hmm. or functional MRI that can give you some idea of what's going on in the brain in terms of blood flow or metabolic activity. But basically, consciousness is a very complicated thing, and these tests can only support what doctors call a clinical exam, which means a doctor's assessment of what the patient is capable of.
Now, as you know, Terry Schiavo's parents say that she is aware, that she does respond to them, and they've released videos that they say demonstrate this. A number of medical experts have testified in court that Ms. Schiavo is not aware or responsive. In her case, she's been in this state not for a month, not for a year, but for 13 years. What do we make of this conflict?
This case represents the, you know, the really cruel paradox of vegetative states. Because the patient's eyes are open and because the patient's reflexes are intact, doctors say that this can often deceive families into thinking that there is awareness, you know, that the patient knows what's going on and can respond. And, of course, families are often desperately hoping to see a response. Specialists tell me that patients can, in a persistent vegetative state, can look an awful lot like they're aware. They can respond to a sound. They can appear to squeeze your hand. They can have a facial reflex that can be interpreted as a smile. So the neurologists who are looking on this case think that very strongly that that's what's going on here. That's just a tragic misinterpretation.
Hmm. Let's get another caller in. Jeff joins us on the line from Santa Rosa, California.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife recently died this July of lung cancer, and it was her wish that she would not put on life support and that she would die at home. And if I had my choice, I'd rather have her alive on tubes in a hospital so I could have her with me. Mm-hmm. So I can't understand where the legislature gets the point to interfere in this. I think the woman in Florida, if her wish was to die at home or not to be on life support, that's got to be respected. And as hard as it is for me, I think that you have to let the person have their wish.
Well,
I believe that there's a life afterwards, so I'm not worried about that. But I mean, if that was my wife's wish, I had to honor it, even though I didn't want to.
Well, Richard Knox, I gather in this case, her husband has testified in court that she had told him that if this should ever happen, she did not want to stay in a vegetative state, but she did not leave any evidence to that respect.
Right, but at the same point, I think it's the ultimate act of love is to honor that wish and let someone go to the other world like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, dying is just part of our living.
Yeah, but there's a conflict here between her husband, who says he wants to let her go, as you suggest, Jeff, and her parents, who say that she's not ready to go.
I understand that, but I think when it really comes down to it, in an intimate relationship, the husband has the final say on it.
Yeah, and Richard Knox, the courts have agreed with what Jeff said.
Yes, the courts have been pretty consistent, going back, at least to the early 70s with the Karen Ann Quinlan case, she was in a coma,
in
allowing withdrawal of care, including food and water, if there was evidence that this was the patient's expressed wish. The problem comes in that often there isn't a clear expressed wish, which obviously is a lesson to us all to try to be clear about what our intentions are.
I understand. But from what I understand, the husband was conscious, but that was his wife's desire.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a horrible situation to be in here regardless.
Yeah. Jeff, thank you very much. I know it's hard to talk about these things, and we're very sorry for your loss.
Oh, but thank you. I appreciate your show. It's brain food. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Richard, what should families do if doctors tell them that their loved one is in a persistent vegetative state? I mean, are there guidelines that we might be interested in following at this point?
Yes. In fact, the American Academy of Neurology on its website, I'm told, has a set of guidelines for doctors that people might want to check out as well. I mean, non-doctors might. Because of there's a lot of confusion and subtlety even among healthcare professionals, I think. One clear message I'm getting is that it's important to get a thorough examination from a neurologist or a neurosurgeon who has experience with these kinds of cases, because many things can mimic a vegetative state that are not persistent. They're reversible, things like stroke and some kind of medications and bacterial toxins and other things. So it really demands careful and expert diagnosis before somebody is called persistently vegetative. And just as important as we just touched on, people should express their wishes in advance of a catastrophe so that there's some guidance for family members and courts about what you want or what you would want.
Richard, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Richard Knox is NPR's health and science correspondent. He joined us from his office in Boston, Massachusetts. As we mentioned, this move by the Florida legislature was highly hasty and highly unusual. To help us better understand why this became of interest to elected officials in Florida, joining us now is the Tallahassee Bureau Chief of the Palm Beach Post, S.V. Date, and good of you to be with us.
Hello, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks. How did this end up in the lap of the legislature?
Well, we really have two reasons for that. One, they happen to be here in town, which in Florida is not normally the case. We have a part-time legislature. They're usually here just for a couple of months in the spring. They happen to be here anyway on an utterly unrelated issue, a project that the governor wanted to push, economic development. At the same time, you have a Senate primary coming up next year, and you have the Speaker of the House, Johnny Byrd, who is one of the candidates. And he has been pushing real hard in the last few months to position himself pretty much to the right of all the other candidates. He tried a couple of months ago to have a special session called for the sole purpose of passing a parental notification act,
mm-hmm.
and was told he could not do that. And this really came as a shock to the Senate, because on Sunday the Senate President Jim King spoke with him and told him, well, we're not really interested in doing this, and we don't think it's the right thing to do, and hung up the phone and thought that was the end of it, only to hear later on that evening that Speaker Byrd had gone on TV and said his plans to push a bill to do just that.
So this, and of course, the Senate seat you're talking about is the United States Senate seat.
No, this is the Florida Senate.
Florida Senate seat.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and this is interesting, because the president of the Florida Senate, Jim King, he was really the prime mover behind the Death with Dignity bill, which passed in, I believe, 1988, And he did that because his own parents died terrible, lingering deaths from cancer. And he said, you know, by God, this is not going to happen to people in the future who want to die quietly, who don't want to be prolonged through artificial means. And he pushed for years, 3 years, before he got this passed. And to him, that's his personal triumph in the Florida legislature. And now to have this guy who's running for Senate come along and take advantage of the situation in Jim King's eyes to use it for political means, that really upset him. I don't know if I've seen Jim King that upset in the 10 years I've known him.
Well, the Florida Senate eventually passed the bill, so what happened?
Oh, absolutely it passed the bill, because the Florida Senate is, like the House, overwhelmingly Republican. I mean, there are, 25 Republican members, and they all face re-election in either next year or 2 years later. And in Republican primaries, you have to be conservative. You have to be extremely conservative, with a very few exceptions. And you know, there were, I believe, 4 or 5 Senate Republicans who voted against it. But yes, it passed. It passed overwhelmingly, like everyone knew it would. And it has left a very sour taste in the Senate's mouth, because they feel it never should have been an issue in the first place.
Yet, Mr. King, on the Senate side, did manage to, evoke some revenge against Mr. Byrd, did he not?
Yes. I mean, there's a little bit of justice everywhere, I suppose. One of Speaker Byrd's biggest opponents is, or most prominent opponents, is a former House Speaker, Daniel Webster, who's now in the Senate. So Jim King let Danny Webster be the sponsor. And so if anyone was going to take credit, Dan Webster could equally take it.
What's Governor Bush's role in all of this?
He did what he could through his legal office for several weeks. And, you know, the law did not give him a role. The law did not allow the chief executive of Florida a role in this matter. And he was really limited in what he could do. I mean, he tried to intervene. He could not. And I believe he was very supportive of the House Speaker when the Speaker decided to go ahead and do it. I mean, I have no reason to doubt Governor Bush's religious convictions. He's, you know, he believes in right to life. He's been consistent with that. He didn't take a lead on this, but at the same time, he did not, I don't believe, try to dissuade it in any way. In fact, you saw how quickly he acted when given the opportunity to do so.
Sure. Now, I assume it goes back to the courts, right?
It goes right back to the courts, and many of the lawyers right here in the Capitol believe that it will be overturned, if not today, tomorrow, next week, eventually, as unconstitutional. Essentially, what they've done is they've passed a general law, and although they did not have the actual name in the bill, they could not. That would make it patently illegal, but they basically narrowed it to affect one person, and I don't see how the courts are going to stand for that.
SV Date, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
SV Date, Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Palm Beach Post and a close observer in the Florida scene. He writes about it in his novels. His most recent is called Black Sunshine. He was with us from his office in Tallahassee, Florida. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Some say that arguments like when life begins or ends should be decided in the legislature by elected representatives. Others say specific cases like whether Terry Schiavo in Florida has the right to live or die should be left to be decided in the courts. Joining us now to talk about whether it's the courts or the legislature who should ultimately have the last word on these issues are Jeffrey Rosen. He's an associate professor at George Washington Law School and legal affairs editor at The New Republic. He joins us from his office here in Washington. Good to have you back, Jeffrey.
Nice to be here.
And Sylvia Law is also with us. She's a professor of constitutional law at New York University. She's represented people seeking the right to choose at the beginning and at the end of life, and she joins us from her office in New York. And thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Neil.
So where are these decisions best made? Jeffrey Rosen, let's start with you. In the legislature or in the courts?
I'm generally a fan of the legislatures. Now, that's not to say that there aren't important constitutional questions raised in both of these cases. In the partial birth case, it's arguable that the Senate and House have refused to recognize a health exception, and therefore that the partial birth bill is vulnerable, according to the Supreme Court. And in the Florida cases you've been discussing, there are important separation of powers questions about whether the legislature has the power to overrule the court's vision of someone's constitutional rights. So I'm not saying that these are ideal legislative solutions to the problems we're discussing, but I do feel that the hard questions about when life begins and ends are often better settled by legislatures than courts. You know, there's a remarkable consensus in the country that early-term abortion should be protected, but late-term ones may be restricted, and figuring out the precise contours of when late-term ones should be restricted really is a legislative act. The Constitution doesn't speak clearly about that. Similarly, in the Right to Die case, the questions of how firm an intention you should have to express before someone can be allowed to make decisions on your behalf really is often best dealt with by legislatures, too. So I hope that we won't allow the fact that these are not terribly thoughtful solutions by legislatures to obscure the encouraging fact that politicians are actually stepping up to the plate and trying to make hard decisions that really should be settled politically.
Sylvia Law, get your opinion.
Well, I don't think it's a black and white question, court or legislature. Let me give you an example. Since time immemorial, the common law has protected our right to refuse medical treatment, even if death is an almost certain consequence. And then as technology developed the capacity to keep people alive, even though they were never going to be conscious again, we confronted the hard question of what should be done about that. I think if a legislature were to reverse the common law rule and say you can never refuse medical treatment if your doctor says you'll likely die, that courts should step in and say that's a fundamental right, that people have a core human liberty interest in being able to decide for themselves whether or not to undergo medical treatment. With respect to the people who are not capable of acting on that choice, most states have taken the approach, including Florida, that says we should try to figure out what the person, him or herself, would want if they were capable of speaking. And that's all but two states do that. And that's not, courts did not impose that rule. Courts would have allowed legislatures to force treatment in situations where we had good reason to believe the person wouldn't want it. But I think, by and large, legislatures have done a pretty sensible job without the courts telling them what to do. This Florida action is absolutely extraordinary. Mm. And I'm sure Jeffrey doesn't disagree with me that Florida had a law, her husband complied with the law, her guardian thought that this is what she would have wanted. For the legislature to come in and overrule the Florida law with respect to one person is nothing short of extraordinary.
Going to continue this discussion after a short break. And a bit later in the program, we'll bring you an update from Benton Harbor, Michigan. That's the town where racial riots took place over the summer. Now a commission has released its report on causes and possible solutions. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, a look at PBS. Is this an idea that's past its prime? Call in tomorrow at this time for your opinions about what you see as the future of PBS. And here are a few of the stories NPR News is working on this afternoon. John Allen Mohammed will not defend himself after all. He's on trial in Virginia Beach, accused of being one of the D.C. snipers. And Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's memo to a handful of high-ranking Pentagon officials cites mixed results in the U.S. war on terrorism. Details on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered. On Talk of the Nation, we're discussing the intersection of law and politics and where the difficult decisions about life and death should be made, in the legislature or in the courts. Our guests are Jeffrey Rosen, legal affairs editor at the New Republic, and Sylvia Law, a professor of constitutional law at New York University. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is TOTN at NPR. PR.org. And why don't we get a listener on the line right from the top here. Ty joins us on the line from Boise, Idaho.
Hi.
Hi.
Taking my call.
Appreciate it.
I guess my my own personal comment as a voter is to say that I don't think it's the place for any legislatures to be deciding what individual people do with their bodies, whether it be choosing to live or to die or anything of that nature. And I do believe that extends into the situation that you're talking about here with the vegetative states.
This in the Florida case of Ms. Chivo, yeah.
Yeah. So I would largely agree with your speaker, Sylvia, and I apologize, I didn't catch her last name.
Her name is Sylvia Law. Good name for a law professor, don't you think?
Yeah, that's what I caught the irony, so I wasn't sure if that was...
I'm sure she's never heard that before.
That was just my comment, and I guess that's all I have to say. Is just, you know, as a citizen, I don't agree that that's the place this decision be made.
Yeah.
There is one comment I'd add to it. I think the thing that complicates it is this becomes a little bit of a gray area as far as the religion aspect is concerned, because there, you know, you talk about the right to life, and it becomes a largely religious issue. And it, to me, I have a little difficulty distinguishing between the church and state issue when the legislature is making this decision.
Mm-hmm.
Because economically, socially, I just don't see how it is beneficial in the long run.
Well, let's get comments on both of those things. Sylvia, we've gotten a lot of calls earlier as well of people saying that, you know, it's not up to the courts or to the legislature. This should be between doctors and patients.
Exactly right. And I think Jeffrey mischaracterizes what Congress has done in suggesting that they drew a line between late-term and early-term abortions.
Mm-hmm.
They precisely and persistently refuse to do that. And the procedures that they prohibit are prohibited throughout pregnancy. And there would still be troubling questions if they had limited it to the third trimester or after viability, troubling in that for some women their health requires that they have abortions that tragically at that very late stage. But Congress didn't bite the bullet and make hard decisions about how you draw a line between early and late. In both these cases, the Florida legislature and the Congress is animated by pressure from very conservative, right-to-life people. I think it's a tragedy that the Republican Party, that was traditionally very strongly pro-choice and pro-liberty, has become so beholden to these people who are willing to impose their views about what's life and what's morality on those of us who have different views.
Jeffrey Rosen?
It's unfortunate that Sylvia Law and other pro-choice advocates are unable to distinguish between early-term abortions, which, again, the courts have said may not be restricted, and late-term ones, which the courts have said may be restricted, and have invited the legislatures to do so. In the partial birth case, there's a legitimate argument about whether or not the line between late and mid-term abortions is drawn crisply, but lower courts have construed similar language to apply exclusively to late-term abortions. It's the fear. Let me try to make this point, because I feel strongly about it. It's the fear that any sort of legislative decisions about hard questions about late-term abortions or legislative decisions about the precise circumstances under which people should make their intention clear to live or die will somehow subvert the fundamental right to choose or subvert the right to die under conditions of great pain. That is both empirically false and also really unfortunate for pro-choice people, because in the long term, you know, the American public has a rather moderate view about all these things, and it's the hard details that have to be settled legislatively rather than politically. That's why I'd say to your caller, too, the Supreme Court itself has invited legislatures to make these hard decisions about the late-term abortions and the details of the end of life. So I'm glad we had this discussion, because it did flesh out the basic question about whether or not we're afraid of the legislature making the hard cases, or whether we want courts to make all of them. And I think it would be good news for pro-choice advocates to make their case in the political arena, because by and large they'll win.
Ty, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome. Can I make one final five-second comment?
Sure, if it's 5 seconds.
The Florida case can easily be solved if everyone out there who listens will get a living will.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Aaron in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania.
Hello. What's the basis for making abortion a federal crime?
That's a very good question. Congress does not normally regulate medical practice, does not normally practice medicine. The most conservative people in the Congress and on the Supreme Court have a vision of limited federal power. It's hard to see how the Partial Birth Abortion Act, so-called, is regulating commerce or doing any of the things that Congress is, in fact, empowered to do.
Was it raised in the last Supreme Court case?
No, the last one involved the state statute.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's true that there's an irony that it's now conservatives who are arguing for an expansive reading of the Commerce Clause, but it would be perilous for liberals to stress this irony too hard, because if you actually embrace the narrow reading, then all the other things that we care about, like the Violence Against Women Act and gun control laws, would be vulnerable as well.
Didn't the court say that, for example, they couldn't make it a crime, a federal crime, to have something happen near a school a couple of years ago?
They did indeed. That was the gun control case, 1995, the Lopez case. And that began this so-called federalism revolution where 5-4 majorities started striking down a lot of federal laws. So you're absolutely right that if we're going to hold the conservatives to their own principles, you might ask why they would approve such a law. But I would caution pro-choice advocates from making this law, because if a future Congress, for example, were to finally pass the Federal Pro-Choice Act that was almost passed during the Clinton years, which would protect early-term abortions even if Roe v. Wade were overturned, that law, too, would be vulnerable according to the narrow logic that you're suggesting. So I think this is one hypocrisy where the conservatives better not be hoisted too much on their own petard.
Aaron, thanks very much.
Thanks.
And I want to get back. We just have a minute or so left, but I wanted to get back to Florida before we leave the discussion. Jeffrey, as Sylvia Law and others have pointed out, this legislation was written very hastily, no hearings or testimony at all. How typical is that for a legislature, and does that tend to undermine the legitimacy of this decision?
I do agree with Sylvia Law that this is very unusual on all sorts of levels, and most of them have to do with the separation of powers. Eugene Volokh, the web blogger, has just pointed out that ordinarily executive officials don't have the power to issue stays. Courts are supposed to do that, and executive officials have to go to courts to get their orders enforced. So it's really not at all clear that the executive has the power to undo a judicial decision, even if it weren't constitutionally based, which it is. And there's also the point that your callers raised earlier, that this does look like a law just passed for a particular person. It lacks the qualities of prospectivity and generality that we usually require of lawmaking, and it might be vulnerable on those grounds as well. So this is certainly not my Exhibit A of a great example of legislative grappling with a hard moral question, but it does show that there's enough political interest about this that politicians are not going to just palm it off to courts, but are going to insist on some sort of say, and I hope in the future they'll find a better way of expressing their more nuanced views.
Jeffrey, I'd just like to point out that I've been involved in litigating a lot of the partial birth cases, and on many occasions judges have said to the proponents of those laws, couldn't you just limit it to the third trimester? And the truth is they are unwilling to do it because they want to introduce the ambiguity that says to every doctor performing any abortion, there's a risk that you can be prosecuted here. And if you drew a clear line like you were advocating, it would be a very different case. But they are not interested in doing that, and Congress wasn't interested in doing that.
I think it's a very fair point, and I agree. I mean, I think these laws can be construed in ways that draw crisp lines that they're constitutional, but you're right that neither side is playing exactly straightforwardly here, and both are trying to use it to address their broader agendas.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because our agenda is we have to go on to the next segment. thank you both very much. Sylvia Law, professor of constitutional law at NYU, represented people seeking the right to choose at the beginning and at the end of life. She joined us from her office in New York. And Jeffrey Rosen, associate professor at George Washington Law School and legal affairs editor at The New Republic, with us from his home in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.